Hello and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors and artists about baseball books, music, film, pretty much anything you can fit on a bookshelf. And that's the slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Many books try to link a premise with a larger thing. If you try hard enough, you can find connections between any items. But Chris Donnelly does a better-than-most job convincing readers how the Yankees explain New York. Now, let's be honest. A lot of people outside the Big Apple think its residents have a superiority complex. New York is bigger, better, and badder than anywhere else in the USA, if not the world. So it's understandable that Bostonians or Chicagoans or Oreganos, I believe that's what they call people from Oregon, dislike New Yorkers, especially its sports franchises, and revel when the Yankees don't do well. While he's not offering alibis, Donnelly is a good educator when it comes to comparing a couple of famous bosses, William Tweed and Yankees owner George Steinbrenner, originally from Ohio. There are also chapters that show how the city reflects the year during different decades, such as this fiscally challenging 1970s and the Wall Street Me Generation's 1980s, when Steinbrenner opened his wallets to sign high-priced free agents in an effort to buy a championship, a philosophy which many outside the metropolitan area view to this day as typical New York hubris. Other sections of the book are similarly educational and entertaining. Here's our conversation. Chris Donnelly, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Hey, Ron. Thanks for having me.
So, your new book, How the Yankees Explain New York. How did that come about?
Well, it sort of combines my two favorite topics, which are the Yankees and history. Triumph Books has a series of these kind of books, How the fill-in-the-blank explains fill-in-the-blank. And this was, I believe, the fourth one. And so we just started talking about it. We fleshed out some ideas. And it took me about 6 months to write it, and just came out recently. So,
now, do you think the Yankees explain their host city better than other teams might?
I do. If you watch, you pick up any team championship video in the last 20 years from any sport, and you're going to hear, well, this is a great example of why this team explains San Diego or Cincinnati, or just pick any town. But I think the Yankees and New York are probably a better fit than most, as I explain in the book, simply because their histories are so eerily unique to one another. And also, Yankee fans are a mirror of New Yorkers in general. And you also have the Yankees themselves who, maybe they were born in the South, the Midwest, but once they come to New York, they sort of take on that New York personality and the New York style. You saw that in the 50s with guys like Mantle and Martin, Whitey Ford. So I do think a very good argument could be made that the Yankees perfectly reflect New York better than any team reflects their host city.
Now, you mentioned people coming from different parts of the country and in fact, the world. Reggie Jackson, when he signed with the Yankees, said he didn't come to New York to be a star. He brought a star with him. But playing for New York isn't for everybody, is it? There are people who had problems when they came here.
That's right. And actually, I do talk about both of those aspects in the book, about how there are people like a Reggie and a Roger Clemens and Wade Boggs and David Cohn, who come to New York already stars, but sort of take on an even bigger life and bigger stardom after the fact. But it doesn't always work out, and I think Alex Rodriguez is a good example of that. And I'm not on the dump on Alex bandwagon, but I do think he's a very good example of an amazingly talented person who came to New York and either did too much to try and make it work or just simply didn't have the personality to make it work. Alex, which, for example, he won the MVP in 2005, and he said, well, this is great, but it'll never be enough. I could win three MVPs. I could do all this and do all that, and it'll never be good enough. And what he does is he sets himself up to this impossible standard that he could never live up to and never has, rightly or wrongly, never has. Instead of simply saying, the MVP is great, but I wish we'd won the World Series, he takes it to the next level. And there's been a whole history of people like that, the Ed Whitsons of the world, who just, New York is just simply not a place for them.
Now, there's also, we mentioned about people come from other parts of this country, but people come from other parts of the world. Mariano Rivera just published his memoir, The Closer, and he talks mm-hmm. about coming over from an impoverished situation in Panama and how difficult that is. And then I'm thinking also of the Asian players who come. As big a thing as baseball is in Japan and other Asian countries, when they get to New York, it's not only playing for the Yankees, which I'm sure is one of the reasons they come, but the whole cultural issues have to come into play here.
Yeah, and I talk about that in the book as well, and how that has worked for the Yankees and it hasn't worked for the Yankees. Hideki Rabu was a case where it didn't work. He was really the first Japanese megastar to come over and play baseball in America. A lot of hype. George Steinbrenner went to great lengths to acquire him, and it built resentment in a clubhouse. Arabu wasn't a guy with a personality fit for New York. He despised the Japanese media, had a very poor relationship with them. And, of course, he didn't, although I think he is underrated in some of the performances that he had, because there were points of time where he was the best pitcher on the team, he didn't perform up to the expectations. And we saw the tragic results of that. But a guy like Hideki Matsui, who was a complete 180, relationship with the media, would take them out to eat every spring training, adored by the fans, always coming through in big moments. So culturally, some people come over and they can adjust very well, and others can't. I feel that could happen anywhere, but there have definitely been examples of that with the Yankees.
Now, you mentioned Steinbrenner. You have a chapter about Steinbrenner and comparing him to another New York political leader, Boss Tweed. Talk about that a bit.
Yeah, it's the chapter is about how they were both in Boss Steinbrenner, Boss Tweed, and how they were very similar people. And that depending on who you talk to, they were devil or angel. George Steinbrenner, if you speak to the players who played for him, most of them, they'll tell you about this guy who started charities. He started charities for the children of murdered cops and firefighters, who did things sort of under the radar that you never heard about, would call about a spouse that was sick, would check up on you if you were in the hospital for any reason. Then you bottle of wine if you hit the 200th home run. But then you also hear from people who worked for him about how he was a tyrant. He fired people on whims. He treated people terribly. He famously fired his PR director because the guy went home for Christmas break, and the Yankees ended up signing David Cohen, which he had no idea was going to happen, and George fired him for it. So you look at Boss Tweed, and he was a guy literally stole millions of dollars, and this is in the mid-19th century, millions of dollars from the people of New York. Basically, he and his organization controlled the books. So if you wanted something built in New York, you had to go through them, and they would tack on this finder's fee, 10%, 15%, whatever, and they would just pocket the money. But they would take a lot of that money and put it back into the city. They would build streets, and he was very big on improving transportation. He was a huge proponent of what would eventually become the Brooklyn Bridge. So there were a lot of people who, even though he was stealing from them, they actually loved him for it. So they're two very unique and very similar personalities who no one can argue didn't change their respective, whether it be New York City, whether it be the New York Yankees.
You have chapters in the book dedicated to certain decades, the 1980s and the Wall Street era, the 1990s. Did you do any research about the team during World War II and the post-war years? Because I'm thinking there were certainly a lot of social changes at the time, but the Yankees stayed away for a long time when it came to integrating the team. Was that indicative of a certain segment of New York philosophy?
It was. I know people, when they sort of think of the civil rights movement and the turmoil, their minds will basically go to the South. But the big cities, especially in the North, had their own issues as well. And New York was certainly no stranger to that, no stranger to race riots and racism. And the Yankees were one of the worst organizations when it came to integration. They were one of the last teams to integrate. They passed up on so many talented people. It's one of the reasons why the National League dominated baseball in the 60s and 70s. The Yankees could have had people like Willie Mays and Henry Aaron and some of the bigger name African-American ball players that came through. And they passed up on them, and they didn't even mask their racism. I have quotes in the book from members of the organization saying why they didn't want these kinds of players in their organization. They didn't want that element on the team. They didn't want that element coming to their baseball games. So it's very, very dark on their history, and suffered for it in the 60s and 70s when the team took a very bad downward spiral. And George Steinbrenner came, and it didn't matter to George care. He didn't care who you were. He didn't win. He was going to have you on board, and if he brought you on and you didn't perform, he was going to get rid of you no matter what race you were. So that, I do talk about that in the book. I talk about Italian-Americans and how Tony Lazzari and Joe DiMaggio and Yogi Berra sort of changed New York City for Italian-Americans because they experienced their share of bigotry too. There's a story about how when DiMaggio was becoming this popular player, I believe it was Life magazine wrote, he doesn't look like your typical Italian. He didn't eat or wash his hair like your typical Italian player. So they've mirrored New York very closely in that way through the years.
Yeah, I remember that article. It said that he doesn't smell like garlic, and he doesn't put bear grease in his hair, but water.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's
yeah.
the way they wrote in those days. When America was about to enter World War II, President Roosevelt wrote a letter to Baseball Commissioner Landis expressing his belief that baseball should go on for the morale of the country. Talk a little bit about what the Yankees meant to New York and the country in the days following 9/11.
Sure. It's going to be... I have a daughter who's 3 and another one who's 2 months, and I think it's going to be difficult to explain to them as they get older just what it was to live after 9/11 and to experience what happened. The shock that the country felt and our lifestyle and as we knew it. You had the Yankees, this magical playoff run that they had, and you speak to people who were down at Ground Zero, who were removing the rubble, who were removing the bodies, and they'll tell you for 3 hours every day, I could count on them to sort of escape all this, to have some relief and some happiness. And it wasn't just that the Yankees were playing, it was the manner in which they were playing. I'm a Yankee fan, I don't hide that. And I think 2001 is actually my favorite postseason run, simply because the games were so exciting, and the World Series that year was so... You wrote a script, nobody could believe it. The games 4 and 5, two out, two-run home runs to tie the game. I was at game 5, and you always hear people say they could see the stadium moving, and you thought that they were full of it. But you could actually see the arms of the upper deck swaying up and down when Scott Brosius hit his home run. It was such an amazing experience. It was sort of cathartic. It allowed people to get out sort of the stress and maybe pent-up anger that they had. And it was something New York really, really needed. They fell 2 outs short of the World Series, but I think in the end, fans and people in general got what they needed. And for one small moment, and it was small because after 2001, everybody went back to hating them, a lot of people rallied around the Yankees.
I think one of the iconic moments, regardless of your political views, is when President Bush threw that strike for the ceremonial first pitch.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was. It's funny because George Bush, very fit guy, sort of very proud of his athletic ability, and earlier in the year, he had opened up Miller Park in Milwaukee, threw out the first pitch there, and he bounced it. And he was embarrassed about that. And so he didn't want to do that again. And that's why he was going to throw from the front of the mound. And he told Derek Jeter that in the famous story, Jeter telling him he'd get booed if he did that. And then right before he comes out, Jeter says, don't bounce the ball. They'll boo you even more. So President Bush gets out there. And amazingly, it's amazing how many of these sort of Hollywood moments happen during this time, but just throws the perfect strike, which, oddly enough, almost no one ever does when throwing out a first pitch. And he nailed it, and he did it in a city that was not a place that loved him beforehand. He garnered only something like 20% of the vote there, but for that moment, everybody was just proud of him and proud to be an American, and it was, again, just one of those Hollywood moments that you wouldn't accept a script that said something like that, but it happened.
When putting a book like this together, is there one period, one chapter, one story that you enjoyed more than any of the others?
I grew up watching the Yankees when they weren't good. The first season I remember is 1990 when Andy Hawkins threw his no-hitter and lost. So I think a lot of younger Yankee fans just think the Yankees have always been great. And I know a lot of Mets fans would shake their head when I say this, but I had to suffer through a couple of years of watching the Yankees. And I'm always fascinated by the 1980s because it is such a crazy period in team history. And everyone is well aware of the Bronx Zoo era because the Yankees were winning championships at the time. And in spite of that craziness, they were winning. They were losing in the 80s because of that craziness. And to me, what happened to the team during that time period is the most fascinating part of the team's history to me. George Steinbrenner is literally firing managers every year. Three managers in the 1982 season. He's firing pitching coaches, batting coaches, two and three at a clip per season. He's firing general managers. You have Billy Martin fighting with a fan on a Friday night in Baltimore, and then you have him fighting with Ed Whitson the very next night in the same hotel bar. You have Billy managing the team, I believe, three different times in the 80s. It's such a crazy period that really reads more like a soap opera than a baseball team. And I always enjoy reading about it, and I always enjoy writing about it.
And we've been talking with Chris Donnelly, author of How the Yankees Explain New York, published by Triumph. Chris, thank you very much for talking with us today.
No problem. Thank you, Ron.
And that was Chris Donnelly, author of How the Yankees Explain New York. Tune in again next time when our guest will be John Chapman, co-author of How the Red Sox Explain New England. And that'll do it for another podcast edition of the Baseball Bookshelf. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to visit Ron Kaplan's baseballbookshelf.com for the latest book news. And remember our Book of the Week contest. That's it for now. Thanks, everybody. Have a good week and see you next time.
Said, boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. Gee, it's a wonder.